Broadcasting live from Forward Observer Central Command in Austin, Texas. It's the man always out front on the issues. You're listening to Out Front with Samuel Culver.
Hello and good afternoon. Welcome to Out Front with Samuel Culper. I am your host, Samuel Culper, and it's been a long time since I've been on the show. On today's podcast episode, we're going to go over what's going to happen in the days to come and take a deeper look really at what the far left has been developing for the past 4+ months. It's been a busy few weeks. I apologize for my absence on the podcast here. A couple weeks ago, I flew out to Utah to meet up with the guys from Fieldcraft Survival and American Contingency. I was on their podcast to talk about the value of intelligence, and I was really glad to be able to spread my message that intelligence matters. No amount of beans, bullets, and band-aids is going to provide you with situational awareness and an understanding of your security environment, especially during an emergency. Only intelligence can do that, and intelligence is produced. It does not magically appear. It does not fall into our laps. If you don't know what your intelligence gaps are, then you are not collecting on them. And if you're not collecting on them, then you are definitely not producing intelligence. And that is really the bottom line. And I've got so many show ideas and notes and stuff. I got to catch up on all this stuff. So let's get on with the show. What does the future hold? Well, bottom line up front, President Trump is more likely than not to win re-election. And let me say, this is not a high confidence statement that he is going to win, but I do think the likelihood is above 50%. I think the polls are wrong. I think most of those polls are wrong. Most of those polls do not correct for social desirability. And if you get into the weeds of a lot of those polls, they overrepresent Democrats, so they're weighted already towards Democrats. And I look at these massive rallies. I mean, what did they have, like 57,000 people in a day or two ago? Was it last night sometime? Listen, last night, Trump got done like past midnight in Miami. He wrapped up his day. He did 5 rallies yesterday. I think he's got 5 more on the docket today. The inside view here is that voter turnout is probably going to be stronger for Trump. I know Democrats have been a little disappointed with their small lead among mail-in ballots. That may change over the next few days. But looking at the early numbers, that doesn't tell you who those people voted for. I mean, you can make an educated guess. But just mail-in ballots by party is favoring Democrats slightly. I look at, you know, let's look at the outside view, which is the polling data, which, you know, I don't put a lot of faith in, but just as one metric, I'll just repeat my caveat about polls. Poll is one data point, and it may not be accurate, but it may still have value. And I look at Biden's lead in these battleground states, and it's actually lower. A lot of these, a lot of his polling in these battleground states is actually lower than Hillary Clinton's was in 2016. So what happened was Hillary Clinton was ahead in Michigan and Pennsylvania and a few other states that Trump actually ended up winning. Biden is underperforming Clinton in those states. So already, if the polling is as wrong as it was in 2016, then we could see Trump ahead a couple of points. And again, that's not a prediction. That's just a single case scenario, one potential outcome. But I tell you, I look at the huge jumps in newly registered Republican voters over the past couple of months, and you look at some other data points, and I think this string of indicators more than makes up the difference in polling data, even if the polls are accurate. And an acquaintance of mine, he used to be at the Hudson Institute. He's been on the show under when it was a different podcast. His name is Michael Pregent. He's another intelligence officer. We were actually in Iraq at the same time. and didn't even realize it. You know, he's come out and he says, yeah, I'm looking at these polls, and he thinks Trump's going to win. And I look at that as a data point, not as confirmation bias. But you know, he actually goes in and breaks it down why the polls are wrong. Who knows? He could be wrong. We all could be wrong. But, you know, when we look at these polls, one thing the media hasn't been saying is that Trump is actually polling within the margin of error. So if Biden is up 2%, but the margin is 4%, then in one scenario, Trump could actually be ahead, which I think is going to be more likely than not the case for a lot of these polls. And by the way, I just saw this Washington Post article bragging that Biden has a 2-to-1 lead among Hispanic voters. But you actually go in and read the story, and you find out that Hispanic support for President Trump is up 30% from 4 years ago. Black support is up. I don't think it's 30 to 40%. I know Rasmussen and someone else came out and said it was somewhere in the range of like 30 to 40%. I don't think that's the case. But let's just say it's at 15%. That is roughly double, I believe, roughly double what it was in 2016. And that is probably going to be enough to put Trump over the top in these battleground states. I mean, the inside view just looks like a Trump blowout. I don't think he's going to win in a blowout. Not in a, I should say, in a landslide. I don't think he's going to win in a landslide. Especially once the rest of these mail-in ballots end up being counted. I do favor him winning. I could see him breaking 300 points in the Electoral College. Look, Joe Biden was going to sit at home for the past week, like a week or two ago. He didn't have anything on his schedule, and now all of a sudden he's been out on the campaign trail. If you're ahead by 12 or 15 points nationally, you probably don't need to get out and go hit Michigan and Pennsylvania, but that's exactly where he is. I think, was it yesterday or today, he's got two in Pennsylvania. He's got Obama down in Florida, and he was with Lady Gaga in Pittsburgh yesterday or today, whatever day that was. I think the Biden campaign has been saying for weeks that the race is closer than the polls show, and I think their own internal polling shows that Biden, who knows, maybe it shows that he's in trouble, but it certainly does not scream Biden blowout, not to me. A Biden blowout, might, you know, he might hit do one event a day, you know, his age and his mental acuity. By the way, if Trump got out there, I don't mean to needlessly editorialize, but look, if Trump got out there and said that all Americans deserve housing, everybody or whatever Biden said, slurred his words like that, and unintelligible, and Biden doesn't even go back to correct it. He just assumes everyone knows what he's talking about. If Trump did that, it would be all over mainstream media. Trump's losing it. Crickets from the media. Of course, these are my own thoughts. They are not necessarily the future. I don't have a crystal ball. I'll be the first to tell you, readily admit, I cannot predict the future. This is what I make of the data points. I do think Trump is more likely than not to win. All right. And by the way, the asterisk here really is, if it's not a contested election, if it is contested, if it does go to a state Supreme Court, if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, who knows? We might be rolling some dice on that, or flipping a coin, rather. All right, so let's move on to talk about these indicators. We do our best to look at information surrounding extremist groups, radical and extremist groups. Our job here at Ford Observer is to put together the puzzle pieces, look at scenarios or look at trends or data points that could lead to political, social, and economic or financial instability. We produce a report every day on this stuff. And I've been doing this now for 4 years, since 2000, actually almost 5 years. In January, it will be 5 years that I've been doing this. And it's been, I don't know, 6 or 7 years since Ford Observer, in some form or fashion, has been my full-time job. What that gives me is a depth of perspective I was tracking a lot of these leftist groups before the average person knew what anti-fascism was. And in 2018, November 2018, my theory, you know, we're looking at organized political violence. At what point do leftists or maybe right-wing militias or right-wing groups, at what point does this move on from just a bunch of a-holes out smashing Starbucks windows and looting Target or whatever? When does it leave there and move towards organized, coordinated political violence? And November 2018 put forth this theory that the development of what we called in the Army combat support and combat service support classes would be the surest and most important indicator that a far-left insurgency actually was developing, or if right-wing groups were doing this on the same scale that far-left groups are. Maybe we would be looking at a right-wing insurgency. But right now, the far-left are the revolutionaries, the government, conservatives. I wouldn't say conservatives. I'll say right-wing groups and the government are primarily counter-insurgents or counter-revolutionaries. I was just on the PrepperNet podcast with Forrest Garvin last week, and I arrived at the conclusion that some months before, the left actually is winning the cultural revolution. I do think they are. I think the country has probably aged about 10 years in the past 4 to 5 months. Well, what is this? June, July, August, September. Yeah, 5 months now. Sorry, I'm not a math major. I got to count on my fingers. Let's go back to 2016, November 2016, when I started tracking these indicators of organized political violence. There were 6, maybe 7 out of 20 indicators of organized political violence, which is to say that an insurgency or some kind of organized, coordinated effort on a much larger scale was not imminent. See, the way this works, I'll explain this again for those of you in Rio Linda. Let's say that we are looking at the possibility that the Russians were going to invade the Baltics, that Russia was going to invade Lithuania or something, or one of those countries. We'd make a list as an intelligence analyst tasked with answering when will Russia invade or where will Russia invade. I'm going to make a list of everything I would expect the Russians to do before they came across the border. So what do they have to do? Well, obviously they have to build out a staging location, or they have to move their troops somewhere closer to the border. They have to begin plussing up their ammunition and fuel. I mean, assuming this is some kind of mechanized or armor or invasion that includes, you know, armor or wheeled vehicles. I'd make a list of all those things, right? And then I would start looking for indicators. I would task ISR platforms. Hey, I'd make an ISR plan. Hey, let's get this drone to loiter over this bridge or to loiter over this part of the country with eyes on this potential staging location. And if we see the Russians moving in their assets to this staging location, that is a positive indicator that they may be preparing to invade. And we'd go down the list, we'd task out all of our collection to try to satisfy these collection requirements, or to collect information that helps us close these intelligence gaps. And then I would look at all this information and make the determination on whether or not I thought Russia was going to invade. Well, let's say that there are just 6 out of 20 indicators. Unless we're missing a lot of information, unless the Russians are practicing very good OPSEC, or they're masking their movements, or they have some kind of countermeasures in place, 6 out of 20 is just not imminent. And then let's just say we'd start ticking up to 12, or to 15, or to 18. All of a sudden, 18 out of 20 indicators, they've pretty much got everything that there that they need to do in order to invade. And now the likelihood goes way up. Just because they have those indicators doesn't mean that they will invade. It just means I can turn around and tell my commander, sir, the Russians have virtually everything they need to be able to come across the border and invade Lithuania or any of the all the Baltic states at that point. So November 2016, I get this list of indicators. There's 20 of them that I come up with. And by the way, most of them are based on Army doctrine, low-intensity conflict. By the way, if you're a Patreon supporter, I'm going to post those indicators for everybody on Patreon. I appreciate your support. In November 2016, we were like at 6, maybe 7. Couldn't decide if that 7th one was really there or not. Or was there a strong enough indicator? 6 or 7. We move on. 1 year later, November 2017. By the way, I was doing this over Thanksgiving break. November 2017, we're up to 12 out of 20 indicators. And in the past 3 years, or yeah, what is it, 2-3 years now, we've pretty much ticked up. I'd have to go through and check, but we're at like 18 out of 20. I think we're just missing maybe like one indicator before this thing maybe breaks wide open. But I can turn around and tell you that, I mean, it's obvious at this point. But yeah, a lot of these leftist groups. And now we can go into different cities and look at capabilities to the best of our ability to observe and monitor and tell you which groups or which cities have the capabilities or which cities already have a proto-insurgency. And that's a different show. It's actually a different report. But what I can tell you is, in general, the far left has developed these, what we would call in the Army, combat support and combat service support classes. What we're talking about here is called a tooth-to-tail ratio. Doctrinally, the Army's tooth-to-tail ratio is somewhere between 1-7, which means 7 support personnel for every 1 gunfighter. Because in a more conventional conflict, combat arms troops, like say some infantry guys in the field, they require sustainment for their operations. They need food and water, okay? They're busy fighting a war. They can't be out gathering their own food and water, these conventional troops. They need ammunition. They've got to have supply. They need vehicle repair. They've got to have mechanics. They need radio communications. They've got to have, you know, field service representatives or, you know, whatever MOS repairs their SATCOM and their SINGARS radios or whatever they're out there using. They need intelligence. They need S2. They need intelligence analysts and intelligence collectors providing them with intelligence on where to go and who to look for and what to expect, right? Because these guys are out there, let's say we're in Afghanistan, these guys are out there trying to disrupt networks or trying to arrest bad guys without an intel guy saying, hey, here's a picture of Muhammad. Like, this is the guy we're looking for. This is the, you know, this is the facilitator. This is the ID cell commander or whatever. They can't be doing this stuff themselves. They need medical support. They got to have medics. Okay, so they got their docs and they got their their surgeons and all that stuff. They can't do that stuff themselves. And there's a host of other services that the infantry needs. The infantry combat arms guys cannot provide that for themselves. They need support. So combat support and combat service support provide those services and sustainment to maintain operations. Now, traditionally, combat support classes include intelligence and signal or communications, the chemical corps, military police. Combat service support, which is one echelon behind them, they include services like finance and quartermaster, which is supply, transportation, which is logistics, and there are some others in there. Now, 2 years ago, when I was looking at these groups, I was seeing very little in the way of dedicated operational support classes among these far-left groups. The far-left groups that were engaged in violence, like the J20, for instance, the Trump inauguration, January 20th, 2017, Those groups that were involved in the violence and in the rioting, they were largely, maybe entirely self-funded, or they were maybe they had some kind of trickle down from social justice organizations that provided protest materials. And of course, you know, they mobilized these mass protests, which are, you know, they say, you know, they, a lot of these leftist groups talk about Mao, you know, and Mao talked about insurgency. He said, look, the insurgents are the fish that live in the water. You think about the fish in the water. Okay, I used to be a fly fishing guide. 90% of a trout's diet they get from underwater. So all these guys out there trying to fly fish with dry flies up on top of the surface and they're not catching anything, that's because 90% of what a trout eats comes generally from the bottom where these bugs are, you know, hatching, you know, these larvae and stuff like that. So you think about a fish in water, and water provides protection. Fish, they breathe underwater. 90% of their diet comes from the water. And Mao's basically saying insurgents get almost everything they need from the populace, from the people who surround them. They get food, they get resupply, they get intelligence, they get medicine and transportation and so on and so forth from the people. And so a lot of these revolutionary groups today will, I mean, they mimic the same thing, which is to say that these, a lot of times these black blocs and rioters, they have been using protesters, a legitimate, mainly peaceful, or was it largely peaceful protest as cover. At any rate, a lot of their equipment, the stuff like the shields and the drums and the loudspeakers and bullhorns and all this stuff, even firearms and these incendiary devices and other accessories that are used in these demonstrations or riots have likely been self-provided. Those guys, even the communists out there who are out there with their, you know, Mosin Nagants or their, you know, they're carrying a Glock or whatever. Like in Austin, we used to go watch the Red Guards all the time, and a bunch of those dudes were armed. Sorry, George Soros is not buying them firearms. Those people likely bought them themselves. Which is to say that, again, a lot of these groups are just self-funded. I still think that's the case in most instances. There may be some external support. If there is, you know, I obviously don't have the multi-billion-dollar infrastructure required to track threat finance is what they call it. I can't track bank statements. That's the FBI stuff, or the Treasury, or whoever. But I still think in most cases, a lot of these groups are self-funded. Which is, that's not to say that some of them do not receive external support. Just that I think, by and large, most of them do not. The best indicator of a developing far-left insurgency, or in most of these cases, a proto-insurgency, is the establishment of these combat support and combat service support roles, because they better enable violence and destruction. And you look at the 100 plus days or how many ever it was in Portland, those guys aren't out there unless they have some level of support. They've got to have medical guys. They've got to have, you know, Riot Ribs was out there providing food, and, you know, they're doing all these crowdsourced projects to get protests and riot equipment and to have enough food and water to give out to these guys. So you basically have I don't want to call them a paramilitary. I actually don't know what the best term for them is. I would call them a fighting force. I mean, they're out there injuring police officers and basically imposing their will in a lot of places out in Portland. What Portland has been able to do over the past 4 to 5 months, we've seen lots of indications that they're doing these criticisms, basically these after-action reviews, and they're talking about what works best and what doesn't work all that well, and they're exporting those techniques and procedures to other groups. what we have seen in Portland over the past 100 days is probably by now a playbook for what might happen over the next 100 days if President Trump wins. And I think, I'll reiterate, there's a very good chance that he does win re-election. Now, this, what I'm about to go over here, I'm about to go into some specific examples, and this is just a draft summary. There are partial findings. We've got a lot more indications than this. But this is what I think everyone should be made aware of. Let's first look at combat support classes. Starting with intelligence. These far-left groups, they've been doxing sometimes legitimate Nazis, sometimes legitimate white supremacists, sometimes just conservatives that they just plain have disdained for and whom they call Nazis and white supremacists. But gathering information online against these people has been relatively easy because they always, you know, a lot of these doxers, they'll post screenshots from Facebook. And you look at someone's post and it has a little globe on there, which means it's public. So a lot of this stuff, it's not that these doxers, some of them are pretty good super sleuths, but, you know, a lot of them, they just go to an unlocked Facebook profile and they go down and they see, oh, you know, this guy posted a picture of Hitler or whatever. And, you know, so it's generally been the case that these guys haven't been practicing a very good OPSEC themselves. The intelligence picture, though, goes way beyond doxing. Since I started following these groups in 2016, they have been stressing the importance of intelligence, these far-left groups. Information gathering and sharing have really occurred in two places. Number one is online, where they've somewhat been able to crowdsource their intelligence gathering. And then they have these things called affinity groups, where they have local groups where they share information, they share intelligence face-to-face. In the past year or so, anti-fascist and other far-left groups have progressed in their intelligence capabilities to include real-time intelligence gathering during demonstrations and riots. I will say, you know, a couple of years ago, I don't think it was all that prevalent. Today, it's very commonplace that these groups do battle tracking using real-time or near-real-time mapping. There are whole, basically, chat rooms dedicated to monitoring police scanners and looking at videos and seeing where police are and updating those locations on a map so that if you're down there on the ground, you know, you can pull your smartphone or whatever device you have out and look at essentially a crowdsourced map of where law enforcement positions are. They have what I would describe as dedicated reconnaissance and surveillance teams. Sometimes these guys are static, so, you know, they'll stand on a street corner and then provide information whenever they do see a police presence. Some of these guys are on bikes. Some of these guys are just foot mobile. And they will literally just go around and scout. And they will look at where the police skirmish lines are. And they'll find staging locations where police are maybe several blocks away. And, okay, great, boom, throw that on the map. And now, I mean, it's very rudimentary, but basically it's feeding this whole situational awareness and the security picture for these guys, and they also provide early warning. These scouts are able to provide early warning with, hey, there's five police cruisers heading west on Bacalacadaca Street, and they're heading towards the protest or the riot. One of the things that we saw just a few days ago is that one of these intelligence teams, were listening to a police scanner, and then police started diverting some of the more sensitive reporting off the police scanner to maybe an encrypted channel or attack channel or something like that. And the intelligence team noticed that, hey, we're not getting as much stuff from this police scanner as we used to. And then they started encouraging people out. They started encouraging the people who are out at the demonstration to begin live streaming the police so that they can make up for that that little intelligence gap that they had once the police scanners were less useful. This is, if there's any slam dunk indicator, if there's any slam dunk case that these far left groups have developed a combat support class of intelligence, it's this one right here. Moving on. There's also signal and communications. So far left groups, they've been relying on social media for propaganda and generally, you know, non-sensitive or non-secure communications. They're increasingly reliant on more secure means of communication. So there are tools like or apps like Signal or Rise Up and Telegram, and there's some other email and instant messaging platforms out there that allow them to send more secure transmissions. And some of these offer end-to-end encryption as well. And we've seen a concerted effort to get people to move to Signal and some of these other communications platforms because they are more difficult for law enforcement to monitor. We've also observed the use of some of these VHF, UHF radios during demonstrations. From a collector's perspective, that's highly susceptible to interception and also direction finding. That's a security vulnerability. I still see these individuals with radios, like in some of these pictures and videos. By the way, these groups, they really have made a concerted effort to police the media or to police independent journalists who are down in live streaming. They don't want themselves to be live streamed because a lot of times those live streams will, you know, that video footage will wind up in police custody when they go to charge these guys. Like, yeah, you threw this Molotov cocktail. We know because here's a video of you throwing this Molotov cocktail. So they've really been trying to shut down kind of unauthorized live streams. Sometimes these groups will use straight up SMS text messaging and instant messaging apps. There's been a lot of guides, especially security guides, published. And some of those best practices include using burner phones, somewhat anonymous communication. Some of these guides say avoid bringing your cell phone altogether because it belongs to you. If it emits a signal, it can be tracked. There's a very good likelihood that people who have brought their personal cell phones to these riots have been identified through their cell phones. And actually, was it a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago? Turns out that was the FBI or DHS, I don't know, one of the two, they collected the cell phones from everyone who were arrested out in Portland. And they ripped those cell phones. They basically just took all the contacts and took all the information off of there. And I think there's a very good chance that after that, they were able to map out most, maybe all, of that entire anti-fascist network out there just based on metadata, based on phone numbers and contacts and all that stuff. There is one thing that using Signal or Telegram or whatever other tool they're using, one thing that allows them to do is develop a reach back capability where now they do have a crowdsourced, you know, maybe there's, you know, two or three, five or 10 people who are monitoring live streams or monitoring other sources of information. And now these guys can ask questions like, hey, is there police presence over here on Fifth Avenue? That's an intelligence requirement. And the use of Signal or some of these other secure communications allows them to do that. It allows them reach back capability for real-time intelligence and situational awareness. And even though they don't need a Signal core to do that, this is a very These are very good indicators that a signal or communications combat support class has developed. Now let's look at a couple of these combat service support. And I'll go through these briefly, but under finance, a lot of these groups rely on crowdfunding. So they'll get on GoFundMe or whatever, and they'll say, hey, we need money for medical kits. Hey, we need money for to bail these guys out of jail. We need a legal fund. We need whatever. And I wouldn't necessarily call this a finance class, but these are indicators that they are developing their own finance mechanisms. And, you know, maybe some of them do have a donor class that can provide money directly to these groups, if that is the case. Or if these groups are getting foreign money or external support, you know, that would obviously be essentially be a finance class at that point. Moving on to Quartermaster. Of course, everyone's familiar with this U-Haul, this video of a U-Haul in Louisville, Kentucky. You know, the U-Haul pulls up, they start unloading signs and shields and other materials to these activists. If those things were centrally procured, then now they have a supply class, at least in Louisville, Kentucky. In many other instances, shields and other products that have been used in these violent clashes with police and other destructive behavior, they have been put together via assembly line. We've seen numerous indicators that a group of people got together one day and said, hey, we're going to make these shields, and they just start making these riot shields. That is an indicator, at least in that instance, of a quartermaster or a supply class. Moving on to transportation. Sorry, but look, no Antifas are getting up in these, you know, 100 passenger limo vans and riding out to rural Illinois, you know, to go burn farms down or whatever. I don't know. There's so much junk out on the internet that's just completely untrue. If they were doing that, then yes, maybe they have a transportation class. Normally what I've seen is, you know, some of these groups, they will go and rent a passenger van, or they will have some kind of, not necessarily mass transportation, but they'll carpool or ride together or whatever. Rental vans are not uncommon. I've seen black bloc anti-fascist groups go and pile in a rental van in at least two occasions, once in Atlanta and once in Dallas. I'm not to the point where I would say that is a standalone combat service support class, but that is an indicator of more centralized transportation. Now let's talk about why this matters. We're just hitting the high points on this stuff, but from the summer of 2016 all the way through last year into this year, I've maintained that a low-grade, low-intensity conflict had already started. And you look at the indicators of insurgency, and we absolutely are in phase one out of phase three. Phase one is incipient insurgency. I do believe that the anarchists and other far-left groups are trying to foment insurgency, which may become more armed. A lot of this stuff has not risen to the level of armed political violence yet. Yes, there have been a few instances, but it is not common. Not yet, anyway. I don't necessarily know that they will get to that point. Let me rephrase this. It's not a foregone conclusion that their activism will eventually become armed activism, and they'll start like robbing banks to fundraise, and, you know, like a lot of the things we saw in Europe with their various insurgencies of, you know, especially these radical leftist groups. These far left groups in the past 4 to 5 months have done more to advance their capabilities than they have in the past 4 years. That is no lie. Their capabilities really have grown heads and shoulders above where they were, you know, say back in January. I said the country has aged 10 years in the past 5 months, and I think these groups have probably advanced about 4 years in the past 4 to 5 months as well. Tomorrow's Election Day. I do think eventually President Trump is more likely than not to be reelected. Even if Joe Biden wins, these leftist groups are not going away. Just like the militias and the 3% groups and stuff, they haven't gone away. What I've seen over the past 4 to 5 months leads me to believe that the next 100 days, if President Trump wins re-election legitimately, but especially if there's a perception that he wins illegitimately, like, I don't know, say a 5-4 Supreme Court decision, I do think we're probably headed towards 100 days of unrest, maybe even farther beyond that. They're already locking D.C. down. I mean, they've already put up barricades, and they're apparently putting up some fence that can't be scaled, and they're turning the greater White House area into Fort Knox, essentially, seems like. I feel bad for a lot of these shop owners in D.C., who've been bored, not just D.C., but, you know, last week we're reporting a bunch of shopping areas, a bunch of cities, are major cities already preparing for days or weeks of violence and unrest. These store owners are throwing up plywood and barricading their doors because they know what's about to happen. A couple of things are still outstanding to me. A couple of questions, rather, are still outstanding. Number one is, when is this low-intensity conflict going to accelerate? I would say that even if there are riots, it's still not be... riots alone are probably not a sign of acceleration. It's really just a continuation of what we have already seen. If there is armed political violence, if there are shootings, if there are a higher volume of attacks against Trump supporters. Like, I was just looking at that D.C. map on ArcGIS. Is it Shutdown D.C., I think it's called? You know, and they had all these Republican and conservative offices, like media outlets and people marked out on a map. They actually put a lot of time and effort into building that map. They're doing what we refer to in the Army. They're doing intelligence preparation of the battlefield. I mean, they even go in there and identify all the bridges in that area. They've marked police stations and hospitals and stuff like that. Just very basic general IPB stuff. But it is intelligence preparation of the battlefield, without a doubt. If this does accelerate into armed political violence, if there are mass shootings, if there is an assassination or maybe multiple, I'm not saying that is going to happen, but that's where my mind is in terms of how does this accelerate. And then the second thing is, if this does accelerate and if we do achieve a new plateau, a new normal where armed political violence becomes commonplace, if we do get there, what is this going to look like in the months ahead? How is the federal government going to react? They're not just going to stand by. We're going to see a massive deployment of federal law enforcement and National Guard, maybe even the Insurrection Act finally be invoked by President Trump if he does win re-election and if the far left moves to armed political. And by the way, this may not be the far left moving to armed political violence themselves. We may have far-right groups out there who say, all right, well, this is enough of this. Local law enforcement's not doing enough, or they're not acting quick enough, so we're going to go out and maybe there's a mass shooting. Maybe there's a firefight. And maybe we do get into this tit-for-tat kind of armed political violence. A dirty civil war. I just saw, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, but I think it's like Richard Hanaya or Henny, something like that. I haven't read the article yet, so I will reserve most of my comments until I've read the article. But basically, he's saying don't count on a civil war happening because civil wars happen in places with much lower per capita income. And apparently, he makes some other points. I think that may be right. And I asked him, I mean, I'm nobody, but I did ask him on Twitter if he would define what a civil war is. Because I think by some metrics, low-intensity conflict is a civil war, and lots of civil wars have been low-intensity conflicts. I think the UN defines civil war as 1,000 deaths per year related to an armed conflict when two sides of a country fight themselves or fight between each other. My wife and I went to Costco this past weekend. We made another Costco run just in case. Maybe there's a general strike. You know, a lot of these leftist groups have been talking about, hey, this is a social movement. Oh, yeah, and then I was watching one of the leaked meetings, apparently from Shutdown DC, and one of the females on there was talking about, well, I don't want to assume her gender, but they were talking about this has to be a social crisis, but a social crisis that we create. And she didn't say the word initiative, but that's what she was getting at. She basically was saying, hey, we have to be on the initiative. We have to be on offense. We have to be the aggressors and force the other side to react. Why? Because if you maintain the initiative of battle, you are in the driver's seat. You are making decisions faster than your adversary can keep up with, and you force your adversary to play defense. That's interesting. That's a military concept. Maybe she's been reading my articles. Who knows? If you want to join my Patreon, you can do so. Patreon.com/outfront. I'll be posting those 20 indicators here shortly. Thanks for listening. I appreciate everyone's support. It seems like it's going to be a bumpy few weeks. Maybe longer. I will be back later this week. I'll do a follow-up later this week after the election, because this is the Royal Rumble, man. It's about to get real. Thanks for listening. Until next time, be well and stay out front.